This is KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Riots in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014 reignited a national conversation about pockets of despair in major U.S. cities. People started asking with renewed urgency about the history of segregation, why a neighborhood in St. Louis should look like Ferguson. A phrase you might have heard, might continue to hear, is de facto segregation. That is, the idea that segregation of neighborhoods is the result of lots of private entities making racially motivated choices based in fear and prejudice about where to live or how to do business. But ultimately, personal choices, not government policy. Well, author Richard Rothstein begs to differ. He says policy had plenty to do with it, and he lays out a lot of evidence in The Color of Law, a forgotten history of how our government segregated America. Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
You get right to the point with that title, no tiptoeing around it.
Well, that's true. The policies that the federal government, as well as state and local governments, followed in the mid-20th century, explicitly designed to create segregation in every metropolitan area in the country, were once well known. There was no secret about them, but we've now forgotten about them. And as you just said, we've adopted this myth that the segregation of every metropolitan area, where African-American communities in particular are circumscribed and concentrated areas of concentrated disadvantage, that this all happened because of personal prejudice and private activity. Whereas, in fact, it was government policy without which we would not have this kind of segregation that we have in this country today, government policy that explicitly, once well known, segregated metropolitan areas.
Now, you're talking really specifically about the period after which, like, laws that just where, you know, like in Kansas City, there was a time where there were just neighborhoods where black people could live and neighborhoods where they could not. And it was very clear. And that is actually really well known here. But even after that era, the policies you're talking about go well into the 20th century, and, you know.
Yes. Yes, well, the policies that you were just talking about, the earlier policies, even those were the product of unconstitutional activity on the part of government. For example, Kansas, like every state in the country, licenses real estate brokers. And the real estate industry had a code of ethics dated back to the early 20th century that prohibited real estate brokers or their agents from selling homes to African Americans in white neighborhoods. This was a written code of ethics. It was a violation of the 14th Amendment for states to license real estate brokers who followed the ethics of their profession. So this was a form of unconstitutional activity. There were throughout Kansas City, as well as all over the country, clauses attached to deeds and contracts negotiated by neighborhood associations that prohibited resale to African Americans. Those clauses were meaningless except for the fact that state courts enforced them. And there were hundreds and hundreds, thousands really, of cases nationwide where state courts ordered the eviction of African Americans from homes that they had legitimately bought in white neighborhoods. The Supreme Court later, in 1948, ruled that this was unconstitutional activity on the part of state courts. But by that time, there had been thousands of these cases, and it didn't become unconstitutional in 1958. It was always a violation of the 14th Amendment for state courts to order the eviction of African Americans who had bought homes in white neighborhoods. Then many more explicit federal policies came into being in the mid-20th century. For example, Your introduction mentioned Ferguson, Missouri. Well, Ferguson, Missouri in St. Louis was a place where the Public Works Administration in the early 1930s created segregation where segregation had never before existed in the city of St. Louis. There were many integrated neighborhoods in the early 20th century and mid-20th century even.
You know, your section on how the FDR's administration did exactly what you're talking about was really surprising to me, because the way we think about FDR and the New Deal is as this egalitarian lifting up. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. And in fact, African Americans benefited from the New Deal in some ways They received benefits from the New Deal that they never had received from government before. But it was always on a segregated basis, designed to segregate them in metropolitan areas. I mentioned a minute ago the Public Works Administration. That was the in 1933, it was the first agency ever to build civilian public housing in this country. And they demolished integrated neighborhoods in order to build segregated public housing. I mention in my book Langston Hughes, whose autobiography, The Big C, describes how he grew up in an integrated neighborhood in Cleveland. He says that his best friend was Polish. He dated a Jewish girl in high school. Well, that neighborhood was demolished by the Public Works Administration, and two separate projects were built, one for African Americans, one for whites, creating segregation where it never existed before. And this went on across the country. This was not a Southern phenomenon. This was a phenomenon that segregated the North, the West, and the Midwest.
The classic story that people have probably heard is the story of Levittown. And I wonder if you could start by kind of recapping that story, and then we'll branch out from there. But this encapsulates sort of like the immediate post-World War II era and what was going on. And I think the role of policy in all of that is also fairly surprising.
Yes, I'd be glad to. And in fact, Levittown is probably the best known example to most people. But in Kansas City, people probably know Prairie Village, which is the same phenomenon. Levitt in New York, in Nassau County, east of the city, wanted to build a subdivision, a brand new suburb with 17,000 homes. He could never have assembled the capital to build 17,000 homes on his own. The only way he was able to do so was by taking his plans to the Federal Housing Administration, an agency of the federal government that had been created in 1934 under the New Deal, and getting their approval for his plans. And it went to great detail about the design of the homes, the setbacks, the architecture, and so forth. But among the conditions that the Federal Housing Administration required him to impose was that no homes be sold to African Americans, and that the deed in every home contain a clause prohibiting resale to African Americans. Well, once he had
And that's from the Federal Housing Administration.
Yes, it's the Federal Housing Administration. And Levitt was able to take this agreement with the Federal Housing Administration to banks and on that basis get guaranteed loans to build the subdivision.
So, and loans that other neighborhoods that didn't have those clauses prohibiting sale to African Americans, that those developers couldn't get those kinds of loans?
Oh, that's correct. The Federal Housing Administration would not guarantee loans, bank loans, to developers unless they excluded African Americans. There was a case I describe in my book. I actually have a photo of this in the book. A developer in Detroit wanted to build a subdivision for white families. The Federal Housing Administration required him to build a 6-foot-high, half-mile-long concrete wall separating his development from a nearby African-American neighborhood, and only once that wall was built did they extend the guarantees that he needed to develop his subdivision.
So what is the relationship between Prairie Village and the story you just told about Levittown? Because in Kansas City, to tell you the truth, when people talk about, the business practices and so forth that contributed to the segregation we see today, people usually talk about J.C. Nichols and the plaza and the surrounding area. Prairie Village, in particular, doesn't come up a lot.
Well, Prairie Village was a subdivision just like Levittown, which had the kinds of FHA subsidies that I just described and with the same FHA requirements. These went on all over the country. You know, the big symbol of mass suburbanization in the country is Los Angeles. California went from a rural area to a giant suburban metropolis. And the Los Angeles, south of Los Angeles, is a giant subdivision named Lakewood, which was built with the same FHA requirements to exclude African Americans. And north of the city, in the San Fernando Valley, there was a subdivision called Panorama City. Both of these still exist. And they were also it was also built with FHA guarantees on condition that no homes be sold to African Americans. So this policy, which was followed by the FHA nationwide, created what scholars later described as a white noose around urban areas where African Americans lived. And it's primarily responsible for the segregation that still exists today.
But so when did these laws come off the books?
Well, these weren't laws. These were federal policies that were written. So they were not, they're not the unintended consequences of benign policies. They were written down. The FHA had a manual which was distributed to appraisers nationwide who actually had to go through the paperwork to approve these subdivisions, and the manual prohibited them from insuring developments that had incompatible racial elements. So it was not laws, but it was equally unconstitutional because it was very explicit racial policy. And again, as I said, this was not hidden. It was out in the open. Somebody who bought a home in Prairie Village or in Levittown knew very well that it was a whites-only development. Frequently, I have another picture in the book of a sign that the Veterans Administration put up in front of one of these developments in Los Angeles advertising its racial exclusivity. So it wasn't hidden. When the Federal Public Works Administration and other New Deal agencies built civilian public housing in the 1930s, 40s, and even into the 50s, it's not as though African Americans happened to apply to some and whites happened to apply to others. It was very explicit. This was an African American project and this other one was a whites project. So this was a open, explicit federal policy, a violation of the constitutional rights of African Americans under the 5th, the 13th, and the 14th Amendments. And because we've adopted the myth that it all happened by accident, we feel no obligation to remedy it. If we understood that it was a constitutional affront, that it was a violation of constitutional rights, under our system, we're required to remedy it. One of the things I say in my book is that letting bygones be bygones is not a constitutional policy. And if we recognize this history, we would have to constitutionally take steps to remedy it.
You know, I mean, we're talking about federal policy but you don't let local government off the hook at all in this book.
No, not at all. First of all, the public housing projects that I've been describing after the first few years were joint projects of the federal government and local housing authorities. So it was not the federal government alone that was doing it. But there were many, many other policies that local governments followed to reinforce this. There were thousands, and I'm not exaggerating here, thousands of instances nationwide where African Americans attempted to move into nearby predominantly white neighborhoods, and they were met with violence. And frequently, more often than not, the violence was police-sponsored. Prosecutors did not arrest those who burned down the homes of African Americans or put crosses on the lawns of African Americans. In some cases, I describe in the book, police officers actually organized the mobs to assault African Americans.
And when are we talking about?
Oh, the 1940s, 1950s in particular. The time when African Americans living in northern cities in particular began to get enough money to move into the same neighborhoods that white working class families were moving into. And frequently, they were willing, African Americans were willing to pay more for housing than whites would pay for similar housing simply because their housing supply, the housing supply of African Americans was so much constricted because there was some private discrimination. And so African Americans were willing to pay more if a family in a white neighborhood wanted to move. It was to their advantage to sell to an African American rather than to a white because they would get more sale price from doing so. But when that happened, there was frequently violence. And again, I'm not exaggerating when I say frequently. And that violence was frequently supported and endorsed by local police and prosecutorial authorities. There's one case I describe in the book in Louisville, Kentucky, where a white family sold a home to an African American, a Navy veteran in this case. The state of Kentucky arrested, prosecuted, and jailed the white seller for sedition. So this was a very state-sponsored activity of ensuring segregation.
You've mentioned this already, but it's something that I found really stark, just that where there had been integrated neighborhoods, that they were actively destroyed and replaced with developments that had these white-only clauses. That is the piece of it that I found most unfamiliar, just the active destruction of integrated communities.
Yes, well, I mentioned the Langston Hughes case earlier in Cleveland, but this St. Louis is another place. You mentioned Ferguson. The city of St. Louis is another place that had an integrated neighborhood downtown, about half black, half white. The federal government and the local St. Louis Housing Authority demolished that neighborhood to build a segregated public housing project eventually.
Is that based on eminent domain?
Yes, yes. They based on eminent domain. They demolished under the federal. There were federal rules permitting slum clearance, and the idea was to demolish low-income housing that was integrated more often than not, and they built segregated housing. You know, the reason that there was so much integration in urban areas in the early 20th century, much more than we have today, is that working families, working-class families, didn't have automobiles to get to work. And so if they were working in downtown factories, the workers, whether they be Irish immigrants or Italian immigrants or Jewish immigrants or rural migrants and African Americans, all were living broadly in the same neighborhoods. And they had to be able to walk to work to the factories, which were pretty much located in downtown areas at the time. So there were many, many integrated neighborhoods across the country. And as the Public Works Administration and then its successor, the U.S. Housing Authority and other federal and local agencies began to build public housing in these neighborhoods, they established patterns of segregation that otherwise would not have existed. The other way in which segregation was created that hadn't previously existed was during World War II, when hundreds of thousands of workers flocked to centers of defense production to take jobs in the war industry. The federal government had to provide housing for these workers. They were moving to cities, overwhelming the resource and housing stock of cities where defense plants were located. And in many cases, these were cities where there were no African Americans living before. I describe in the book an instance in California, Richmond, California, which is a center of shipbuilding. There were virtually no African Americans living in Richmond before World War II. By the end of World War II, the population of Richmond had blossomed from less than 20,000 to over 100,000. There's no way a community can absorb that kind of population increase, and the federal government came in to this community, which, as I said, had no substantial African-American population. There were few domestic servants living there, and built separate housing projects for African-Americans and for whites. The African-American projects were built along the railroad tracks and in the industrial area. The projects for whites were built in the more residential area that had been predominantly white.
Yeah, these sort of idyllic villages.
Yeah, and creating segregation where it hadn't existed before.
You emphasize again and again that you are not uncovering a history that's secret or hidden, forgotten but not hidden. Can you explain the importance of that distinction?
Well, the importance of that distinction is that these policies were open and explicit, so they were blatant constitutional violations, as we understand the Constitution today. And the fact that they were not considered constitutional violations at the time does not, there's no escape clause in the federal Constitution that says that if somebody ignores the Constitution because they don't know any better, that he can get away with it. We're still obligated to remedy it. And as I say, it was written in federal policy manuals. It was open when you applied for a public housing project. It was obvious to anybody who, I mentioned the real estate industry that was licensed by state governments and that had explicit rules prohibiting integration. So this was a very explicit, unconstitutional policy, and it demands a remedy.
Call 816-235-2888 with your questions or observations about the government's role in creating the segregated neighborhoods that persist today. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Richard Rothstein, author of The Color of Law on KCUR's Central Standard. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm talking with Richard Rothstein. He wrote The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. He's going to be in town next week, both in Kansas City and Lawrence, giving talks. And Richard, I'm curious about just the time period when you've been writing this book. The conversation about race has changed and evolved fast in this country. And I wonder how the overlap of what you were researching and what was in the headlines affected you, or how maybe you saw things a little differently?
Well, I don't think I saw things differently, but when I started writing this book, I had no idea that anybody would pay attention to it, because at the time I started working on this, we weren't talking about race in this country. We had this idea that we were a post-racial society and that the only thing that mattered was socioeconomic status and not race. And then, as you said, the violence in Ferguson, Missouri, and in other places erupted in 2014 and after. And as a result, there's great interest in these issues, and that's why I'm on your program.
There's a phrase that I've heard you somewhat object to that has become part of the conversation about race, the phrase people of color. You think it's important, or so I understand, to make a distinction about specifically African Americans, especially when it comes to the policies we're talking about.
Yes. I describe in the book that there are a number of euphemisms that we use to avoid confronting this history today. One of them is people of color, in which we suggest through the use of that phrase that African Americans and low-wage immigrants, whether they're from Latin America or perhaps even from Asia, all have the same kinds of problems, and they do not. We should certainly do a great deal, more than we're doing, in my view, as a matter of social and economic policy, to help low-wage immigrants integrate into mainstream American society. But that's a very different problem from the problem of dealing with the unconstitutional segregation that African Americans have suffered and whose results still impinge on them today. It's a good idea as a matter of policy, as I just said, to improve the social and economic conditions in which recent immigrants, low-wage families of all kinds, rural whites, to improve the conditions in which they can experience greater mobility, upward mobility in this country. But that's a matter of social and economic policy. We should discuss it, debate it. We're not under a constitutional obligation to do that. We are under a constitutional obligation to remedy the segregation that African Americans continue to experience to this day. And that's why the distinction is so important, and that's why I believe a term like people of color obscures the constitutional obligation that we face.
You know, one of the areas where segregation is really persistent in Kansas City is education, which, of course, is not unrelated to housing, where, you know, the place where you live has a lot to do with where your kids will go to school. And I'm curious if that's something you see pretty consistently throughout the country, this sort of hand-in-hand situation.
Absolutely. Schools are more segregated today than they ever have been in the North, the West, the Midwest. And that's only because the neighborhoods in which schools are located are segregated. And segregated schools cannot succeed. It's not that they're bad schools. They may do more for the pupils who enter those schools than middle-class schools do for their pupils. But when you have schools that concentrate children with severe social and economic problems, whether it's the stress of parental unemployment or poor health because of environmental conditions in low-income concentrated neighborhoods, you concentrate those children in single schools. The schools are overwhelmed by those problems. And no matter how good the teachers are, no matter how high their expectations are, they can't achieve the same as they can for children who come to school without those stresses, in good health, ready to learn. And so we have an enormous achievement gap as a result between African-American and white children. And it's all because of the fact that we segregate African-Americans into designated neighborhoods, and that's where their schools are located. If you took a poor, low-income child, assuming that the family is poor and has a few resources, and place that child in a middle-class school, a teacher can devote special attention to that child, and the child can perhaps do better than he or she otherwise would. But if you take children with those kinds of serious social and economic problems, those impediments to learning, and concentrate them in single schools, every child can't get special attention. The curriculum is necessarily remedial. These are children who haven't had high-quality early childhood experiences. They haven't had high-quality after-school and summer experiences. The curriculum is necessarily remedial. Children who come to school in great stress because of living in neighborhoods that are stressful, act out more, so more resources and attention have to be devoted to behavioral management. So the idea that we can somehow solve our educational problems while maintaining segregated schools is fallacious. And the only way we can desegregate schools is by desegregating the neighborhoods in which they're located.
Let's talk with Greg in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Greg.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What can you share? What's your question?
So the late Kansas City African-American historian Joe Louis Maddox was a student of this, and you can go to the Missouri Valley Room at the public library downtown and find out more. But there are a couple of communities where after the Civil War, freed slaves remained, one of them being the West Side and the other one being what was called Steptoe, which is west of St. Luke's Hospital. Little of those remain. And of course, the communities had segregated churches and segregated schools, but they lived in neighborhoods that were relatively integrated. If you look at the West Side, it was Irish immigrants, German immigrants, you know, Latino immigrants, blacks who were freed slaves who actually lived there longer typically than the immigrants did. And they stayed, and they had their own school, and they had their own churches, and you know, they existed like in Westport or the West Side in a somewhat more integrated environment. It always has fascinated me, that history, and it also exists in rural areas too, where the slaves were freed and didn't move until the Ku Klux Klan arises in the Jim Crow era of the early 20th century. But anyway, you know, I think it's a part of history. You know, the sort of myth that you couldn't live west of Troost. You know, there were communities of blacks who lived and had their churches and schools segregated and unequal that were, you know, in the West Side and Steptoe, among others.
Well, Greg, thank you. And I want to give our author a chance to respond to what Greg said, but I also want to tell Richard, you know, that he mentioned a character by the name of Joe Louis Maddox. He recently passed away. He was an independent historian here in Kansas City, African-American, and really part of the community he researched. And so he had a lot of oral histories, a lot of conversations with people in neighborhoods. And I wonder if that kind of historian is important to making sure that histories in plain view are not forgotten.
Oh, very much so. You've just told me something. I'm going to be sure to visit that museum next Wednesday when I'm in Kansas City. The research I did was only in part based on historians like that. I was more interested in federal policy, so I was looking at federal rules and federal policies, federal manuals, as I mentioned before, the underwriting manual. Looking at it from the side, from the perspective of the victims, is equally important, and I'm always fascinated and moved and disturbed by those accounts. I do talk about one man whom I was lucky enough to be able to interview in creating this book. He passed away recently, and about his experiences of returning, like many returning war veterans, was not able to move to a home in a predominantly white, in a white, all-white suburb that the FHA had created. This was a war veteran who World War II came back. He was very entrepreneurial. He bought some surplus army trucks and reconditioned them to haul sheetrock to Levittown when it was being built. He was a lower middle class businessman. He was unable to buy a home in Levittown, even though he had participated in the building of the community. So yes, those are very important perspectives, and I thank you for letting me know about the Kansas City Museum, and I will be there.
Well, I guess just so that you know, it's really, I was telling, there's a man who did this research who has passed away. There's not, unfortunately, a museum.
Oh, okay.
I wish we could offer you a museum of his studies.
Maybe next time.
This point also that our caller made about communities of freed slaves, is that something that factors into this history in an important way?
Well, perhaps it does, although my focus is mostly on the North, the West, and the Midwest, where there weren't communities of freed slaves because slavery wasn't being practiced there. And the reason I'm focused on that is because part of the national myth that we have is that segregation was something that only occurred in the South or perhaps in some border states. And it's important for us to recognize and confront the fact that the government created segregation across the country. This was not a particularly a Southern phenomenon, not even primarily a Southern phenomenon.
Yeah, it's very complicated here because of Missouri. You know, we are in the Midwest, but Missouri having been a slave state, and then in Kansas, communities of what they called exodusters and other things like that.
Right.
Let's talk to Dave in Lenexa. Hi, Dave.
Hi there. Hey, was wondering, and I understand that your book follows through the policy of the 40s and the 50s. Could this just really be a continuation of what we call here, at least, white flight out of the city into these areas? And maybe the government just memorializing in some way their policies in the 40s and the 50s?
Well, white flight would not have existed to the extent that it does. I'm not saying there aren't some families who would have fled a neighborhood that was integrated, but it would not have existed to the extent that it did without government policy. Recall the stories I was telling you a few minutes ago about the Federal Housing Administration and creation of these suburbs. They subsidized the white population to flee the city and move into all white suburbs. I mentioned earlier that there were separate housing projects built for whites and for blacks. The white families could leave those housing projects and move to the subsidized by the FHA and the VA suburbs and pay less in their monthly carrying charges for those single-family homes than they were paying for rent in public housing. The other aspect of white flight that we have to recognize is that white flight was frequently based on the fear that when African Americans moved into their neighborhoods, that the neighborhoods would deteriorate, that they would become slums, that the property values would decline. As I said a few minutes ago, in fact, initially property values rose in neighborhoods that were integrated, that began integration, because black families who had the money to buy single-family homes were willing to pay more than whites were for the same dwellings. But once African Americans were concentrated into a single family, into neighborhoods of concentration, the city services typically deteriorated. They were overcrowded because African Americans had so few housing choices, so they subdivided their homes. They did become slums. Whites looked at these communities and assumed that slums were a characteristic of the slum dwellers rather than conditions that were imposed by government on them by restricting their housing supply so severely. So I'm not suggesting that it wasn't prejudice. Of course, there's a lot of it in this country. We see that today. I'm not suggesting there wouldn't have been white flight without these conditions, but it was substantially supported and enhanced by federal policy, and opposite federal policies would have reduced it.
I was just about to take a call from a listener who wanted to hear more about Prairie Village. She was curious about covenants that that discriminated against other groups as well. And I wonder what you know about that.
Well, frequently covenants did discriminate against other groups as well, but they weren't enforced to the extent that they were enforced against African Americans. So I know of very few, I don't know of any cases where courts actually evicted in any substantial numbers Jews or Asians or others who may have been covered by these covenants. In California, there were frequently cases where the covenants excluded both African Americans and Hispanics, but the courts refused to enforce them against Hispanics. They only enforced them against African Americans on the grounds that Hispanics were Caucasians and the covenants could not apply to them. So it's a complicated history. It's certainly true that the covenants prohibited sales to others than African Americans, but the enforcement by the courts was primarily directed at African Americans who attempted to move into white neighborhoods.
You know, you are an economic researcher, and I'm curious about, though, what your personal relationship to this subject matter is. You're clearly really passionate about it, and I wonder what you've experienced or witnessed that maybe inspires you to do the work you do, to uncover the kinds of forgotten histories you do.
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm actually not an economist. I was a specialist in education policy until I began this work. I was once the education columnist at the New York Times. And I was concerned for years about the achievement gap between African American and white children. And I gradually came to the realization that the achievement gap is primarily a function of segregated schools, and it doesn't take a keen sense of observation to see that the reason that schools are segregated and increasingly segregated is because of the segregation of their neighborhoods. So that's the motivation for looking into this. My ultimate initial goal was to figure out what we can do to improve the educational experiences of low-income and minority children.
You know, that's interesting because this book, and I know you've talked about this before, but it is not focused on how to fix the problems resulting from policy-based segregation. It's on just making the case that this exists at all. But why not? Why not take that step of suggesting solutions?
Well, I do, in the book, suggest solutions, but I don't place great emphasis on them because until we develop a new consensus that abolishes the myth of de facto segregation and understand that we have an obligation to remedy this situation, we can't have the kinds of national conversations that are necessary to develop these policies. Any policies that I suggested would seem ridiculous in today's political environment because there's no understanding of their necessity. So I do have a number of suggestions. I mention them in the book, but I don't place emphasis on them because my primary goal is to get awareness of the obligation to do it.
Richard Rothstein, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Richard is the author of The Color of Law. He'll be speaking at KU in Lawrence on September 5th and at the Kansas City Public Library on September 6th. Up next, what an outgoing curator has to say about Kansas City's art scene as she leaves for Chicago. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm talking now with Lynette Miranda, who came to Kansas City last August as the curator in residence for the Charlotte Street Foundation. She came with an impressive resume, which included stints at the Museum of Modern Art in New York and the Art Institute of Chicago. Her residency here lasted exactly 1 year, so she's just left. As she settles into her new job in Chicago, we're going to hear about her impressions of the art scene in Kansas City. Hi, Lynette.
Hey, Gina. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good. Excited to talk to you guys this morning.
Well, what was it that attracted you to Kansas City enough to want to be a part of this arts community for a year in the first place?
Well, before moving to New York, I had lived in Chicago, and I had a lot of colleagues in Chicago that had mentioned Kansas City, and I met a lot of former Kansas Cityans that would visit Chicago and really rave about the artwork going on, the experimentation, the artist-run culture, and the art galleries. And so when I was looking at this opportunity, I really wanted to be in a Midwestern context. I wanted to be in a smaller city full of energy, which is what I definitely found when I moved to Kansas City. And those were my initial motivations to go to a community where I would be able to learn about new artists in a new context.
Did you find the kind of experimentation and artist-run culture that you'd heard about?
I did, but interestingly enough, as I entered the community, a lot of those people that I had met had been leaving within the year or the last 6 months before I came. And so when I came to Kansas City, there was a kind of, there was a lull of that kind of energy. Not that it doesn't exist and that it didn't exist, but even from individuals that had lived there that I was meeting, you know, they kept talking about this culture coming in waves and how I sort of came at the time where everybody had just left and new things were starting to percolate under the surface.
So, you know, I guess one of the things that I'm curious about has to do with something you said early on in your arrival. I was looking back at some of the articles about you as you arrived in town and that you were hoping to come and challenge conventions as well as bring local and global discourse together here in Kansas City. So I'm going to talk to you about those things real quick. How did you go about trying to challenge conventions here in Kansas City?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of ways, but for the sake of this conversation, was really thinking about what art and what artists existed at the margins in Kansas City, in terms of the type of art they were making, but also in terms of the type of individuals they were. So one of the things that people have often asked me during my time is like, if I was considering staying in Kansas City, And oftentimes I give a, you know, good enough answer. But the two things I often cited was that it was really hard for me to think of myself as somebody to stay in Kansas City for a long time, because I didn't have enough of a community of artists of color around me. It was a very predominantly white art community. That doesn't mean that artists of color aren't there actively working and organizing, but just that the center is really around, you know, like many institutions and many other communities and many other cities, just really around white identifying folks.
You know, and I want to talk about your own, I mean, how you identify as part of this, because first of all, you are an artist yourself in addition to being a curator. That's part of your background. And also, as I recall, you identify as Latinx.
Yes, correct. And so, I identify specifically as a brown curator.
So how did that feel to you in Kansas City personally, not just observationally?
Yeah, personally, it was very isolating. I think that I took for granted that in other big cities, while these problems exist for sure, and it's not just Kansas City, I took for granted that a lot of people around me talk about it out loud. And in Kansas City, I found that there's a lot of really good intentions and a lot of really sort of nice enough people, but people are really not open to talking about it as openly and as critically as I was used to.
Are you able, without naming names or anything, are you able to give an example of a time where it would have felt natural to you to have a conversation that people around you just weren't willing to have?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's not about willingness, because I think that I have approached different people of all different backgrounds and experiences in a way that's not, it's not combative. So I think once I open the door, people are willing. But I think that there have been many times in my experience where people hear something I say or look at something I've written or take a comment out of context and sort of get defensive about me being critical, just even saying this out loud to you, that, you know, we aren't really comfortable in the Kansas City art community to talk about the systemic and underlying issues that affect the art community, and the fact that it has a diversity issue, like I said, like many other communities. So I would often experience this sort of like undertone of sort of resistance when my first show opened, which I had spoken to you guys at KCR about to promote. I had heard sort of from the grapevine that some people felt alienated. It was an all people, a show that was all people of color. It was about embracing identity. It was a week after the election. And to hear back comments that people felt excluded, white identifying folks felt excluded, or they felt like it wasn't for them, or like that they were marginalized, was really telling to me, because it was me trying to center voices at the margin, including two local artists that, you know, were coming out of undergrad, really trying to investigate these questions of identity. And you have sort of audiences in the art community feeling marginalized for the first time, maybe. And that's not my intention. I'm trying to welcome all types of people in my shows, but that's indicative of people not wanting to even acknowledge the problem and have the conversation.
You know, when you talk about some of the systemic issues in Kansas City's art scene, I wonder if you can give us a sense of what you mean by that. Like, what are some of the areas where we could improve, or just what are maybe some of the behind the scenes workings that people not in your position might not understand?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's a few things, but one of the things that I often notice is that a lot of people that do want to make this change and want to be reflexive about their own process, they go out there and maybe they identify key folks that are artists of color that they want to support. And they think that that's enough. And that's great. I want artists to be supported regardless.
You're talking about like organizations here in town?
Yeah, organizations, individuals, like, you know, that is one part of my work as well, sort of supporting artists. and artists of color specifically by, you know, just like giving them opportunities or meeting with them, talking with them. And that's totally fine and great. But then there's that next step that I don't see happen, which is building systems around creating that opportunity for those people of color that we're not seeing and we're not engaging with. So how are we creating a pipeline to support these individuals? When I came to Kansas City, there was a slew of Kansas City Art Institute students of color that asked to have coffee with me, that told me that they did not feel supported at their institution because they weren't willing to have the conversations. Now, this is a generalization because each of them have their own experience, but just broadly, broad strokes, they were telling me that they didn't feel supported. Their professors couldn't have those conversations with them. This is clearly not everybody there. There's really amazing faculty at the Kansas City Art Institute, but it was telling to me that me as a new person that they didn't know at all, they felt comfortable enough to come and talk to me about these issues within the month or two that I moved to Kansas City. So those were students that I had met with that definitely are critical as students sort of coming up in this art scene. And it showed me that there's no access point to talk about these things, but then we're not thinking about strategies or solutions. So one of the things in terms of thinking about constructive criticism is this is more broad and it's less about racial or ethnic diversity, but there's no transparency or accountability in this art community. The only time that I've really seen something that seemed that for me felt really productive was when Front Space, which is
Wait, can I back up for a second? Just because I want to understand what you mean by that there's no transparency or accountability. Can you flesh that out for me a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the common criticisms that I hear in Kansas City that I don't understand as well as the artists in the city is that they don't understand institutional or organizational processes of how resources are allocated, whether it's opportunities for funding or how decisions are made. There's a sort of undertone where I kept hearing about this history of Kansas City where everybody thinks that their friends are helping each other out, you know, and so it's like a really personal thing. I don't think that is true. I think that's an assumption.
Oh, so like the qualifications or something, that no one has a sense that there is a clear cut set of qualifications to get a grant or that kind of thing?
Yeah, and I think or like residency opportunities, or I think that there's lots of opportunities, there's lots of juries that happen. And I guess what I'm saying is that those processes are happening and they're improving, but artists don't know about it. And then if they're not happening at other institutions and they're not improving, all of the sort of, it all gets lumped into one sort of barrier for artists that maybe don't even feel like they can participate in these systems to get these opportunities, which often happen to be artists of color.
So it's like a sense of you have to know the right people and be part of the right group?
Yeah. And again, I want to clarify that I think that's the assumption. I don't think that's often the truth, but but that is the case with some in some other senses.
Are there situations where an art community being very personal can be a positive thing, and just other situations where it's negative, or is it something we really need to grow beyond?
I think that it's important to balance both, because it's really great to build friendships and build relationships with artists and build community. But at the same time, we need to have objective ways of figuring out how resources are allocated, because otherwise it's just this constant issue where only a select few are getting those opportunities.
Well, our time is up, but Lynette Miranda, good luck in your next chapter and don't be a stranger, okay?
Thanks so much, Gina. Have a good one.
Lynette Miranda was the curator in residence for the Charlotte Street Foundation for the past year. She's just completed her residency and moved to Chicago. You can listen back to today's show at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's where we keep all of our past conversations. So go to kcur.org/centralstandard and have a really good time listening to all of those shows. All of them. That's right. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about white identity. It seems to be in crisis right now, and we're wondering if we know how to talk about being white. Join that conversation tomorrow at 10. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Danielle Hogarty. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.